Mathematician Tries to Understand the Rock Charge Quantization, I think would be a more accurate title. So thank you. So my talks, unlike a lot of the other talks, will be about field theory, not about string theory, although some of the field theories will be low energy limits of string theory, and in fact the rock charge quantization condition that I'll talk about is motivated by things in the string theory. So when we talk about field theory, we're talking about, in the first instance, let's say this is Minkowski, space-time, and we're talking about fields which are basically functions of various sorts on Minkowski space-time. So we might have scalar fields, spinner fields, metric, if we're doing a theory of gravity, Rieder-Schwinger fields, and so on. But the ones that I want to focus on are fields which are differential forms. So that's the notation for differential forms. And we might have fields of forms of various degree which occur as fields. So, and they might have different physical meanings. So for example, a current, electric and magnetic currents, occur as differential forms. There are also things called field strengths. There are gauge fields, and also gauge transformations. And all of them are differential forms of various degrees. And in fact, if we call the field strength of degree d, then the gauge field has degree d minus 1 and a gauge transformation of degree d minus 2. So these occur, and I should say that what I'll talk about is strictly abelian gauge fields. Nothing about non-abelian gauge fields will appear in these lectures, in the main part. So, so for example, when the most familiar case, perhaps, is when d is equal to 2. And so that's the case where the gauge field is a one-form. And that's the case of, for example, classical electromagnetism, which I'll talk about in a minute. We could also consider the case d equals 1. D equals 1 you might not think of as a gauge field. That's the case when the gauge field is a zero form. That is to say, this is just a scalar field. And since in that case d minus 2 is negative, there are no gauge transformations. So in that sense, it's not a gauge field, but nevertheless, it fits into the sort of story that I'll talk about. And that will be, in fact, the main example that I'll use today, since geometrically that's the easiest one to see. But there are other cases which occur in theories of interest. So for example, d equals 3, that's the case where the gauge field is a two-form. And there are various theories which have the so-called B field, and the geometry of that B field has gotten a lot of interest recently. And so that's an example where d is equal to 3. And there's also an interesting example where d is equal to 4, and that is the sort of three-form gauge field in M theory. And unfortunately, I'll have nothing to say about that particular example. And there's another example for various d, which occurs, which are the Ramond fields in type 2 supergravity and type 2 string theory. And so there are lots of theories, particularly in higher dimensions. Really, you don't see these higher form gauge fields in low-dimensional theories, but in high-dimensional theories of supergravity particularly, and those supergravities as low energy limits of string theory, you see differential forms of higher degrees. Okay, so the lectures will be, in some sense, mainly about those. Now, the main sort of themes that I'll say are the following, that in a classical theory, we can think of these fields as differential forms. there's no problem with constructing a field theory with them as differential forms. But in the quantum theory, there's Dirac charge quantization. And the charge quantization forces us to reconsider what kinds of geometric objects these things are. So these things, as fields describing a quantum theory, say for a functional integral formulation, will locally be differential forms of this type, but globally they will have a different nature. And that's quite familiar, for example, for a usual abelian one-form gauge field. We think of that not as a real-valued one-form, but as a connection, perhaps, on a circle bundle. And so we have to understand what the generalization of that is to higher degrees and what other possibilities there are. So that's where the sort of new mathematical content is. That's a theory called differential cohomology. Maybe the word generalized should be in there somewhere. But the embarrassing feature is that a systematic treatment isn't quite written down yet. And anyway, I'll talk more about that tomorrow. But in some sense, the examples that I'll talk about are motivation for constructing a systematic mathematical theory, and they're good examples to have in mind when constructing the theory. So it's a little bit backwards for a mathematician, perhaps, to do and write and talk about the example before the theory. Yes?
Is that embarrassing?
Well, I don't know. I will say, though, that there is a paper about to appear, if that's what the question was, by Hopkins and Singer, and that will appear shortly. I was just told this morning. Yes? Did you have a question? No. Okay, well, I don't know exactly what that question was. But more about that tomorrow. Okay, so one theme is to describe a little bit about this differential cohomology and what kinds of objects these things are. And one of the recent features that was quite nice that's mentioned this morning, which we can approach with good hindsight, is that this Dirac charge quantization can be done not only with integral cohomology, which is the traditional one, but also with other cohomology theories. That's what the generalized. So, for example, K-theory, as it occurs for the Ramon-Ramon fields. Okay. Another theme, which we'll get to even today, is that the presence, if we have simultaneously electric current, we'll call it JE, and also magnetic current, JB, then this produces an anomaly. So I'll have to explain what that is. So these gauge fields can produce an anomaly by simultaneously having electric and magnetic current. And this occurs in particular when you have what are called self-dual fields. So a feature of the examples that I'll talk about is that they do involve self-dual fields, and at some point in the lectures I'll have to talk about self-dual fields a little bit, although that's another place where my understanding is not as complete as I would like. And the third theme is that the cancellation, of this anomaly against fermion anomalies, so I'll have to review fermion anomalies, that's what's called the Green-Schwarz mechanism. And if we do the charge quantization properly, then we'll understand this not only in terms of local anomalies, but global anomalies. So the complete story there. And what for me is the beautiful thing here is that this actually involves, not surprisingly perhaps, the Atiyah-Singer index theorem. But it's not the form of the index theorem that you might know. For example, it's not a form of the index theorem which can be proved by methods from physics. In fact, the only proof I know of the index theorem in this form is from the papers of Atiyah and Singer in the 1960s. Namely, it's the version that involves K-theory, and in one case even KO-theory, for families of Dirac operators which might be real, and the entire index theorem as a K-theory theorem, not as a cohomology theorem and not over the reals. So I'll have to explain a little bit about that, but this cancellation comes that way. So roughly the story is, in these examples where K-theory enters, that this anomaly is some sort of integral in K-theory, whereas this fermion anomaly is something to do with Dirac operators, and the fact that that something, Fafians of Dirac operators, can be computed by some integral in K-theory, that's exactly what the Atiyah-Singer index theorem says. So that's really the goal of the lectures, is to try to explain those. And there are two main examples where, two examples that I'll explain where that occurs. So the examples I want to explain are when we have D brains in type 2 theory, there are anomalies with the theory on the D brain against the theory in the bulk and so on, and the cancellation of those anomalies involves that mechanism. And then what's actually a harder case is the original case of Green-Schwarz, which is the type 1 string, but the SO32 case of that. So I'll talk about the global anomalies in the type 1 string. There are references, by the way, for these. So I'll put those up once. So this one is a joint paper with Mike Hopkins. And the other one is this one. Okay. And in large part, I'll actually be following the second paper to try to explain about gauge fields. So that's the plan. And so I want to start by starting back on common ground. So I hope it's not too embarrassing to start here with Maxwell's equations. And okay, so let's start with Maxwell's equations. So we'll start in the really traditional context of Maxwell's equations. So we'll look at space-time where we have, here's time. E1 is Euclidean one space. It's a line, doesn't have an origin. There's no zero of time, at least I hope not. And we have space, which is Euclidean three space. And the fields in, so that's our space-time. And we have an electric field, which I'll take to be a one-form. Let me just call this N, space N. And we'll have a magnetic field, which is a two-form. And then we'll have an electric charge density, which is a three-form in space, but it has compact support. So charge doesn't somehow leak off to infinity. And similarly, there's a current, which is a two-form in space, again, with compact support. And the Maxwell equations, so usually we learn these with vector fields. I've made at least one step in translating it to differential forms. The Maxwell equations are that dB equals 0, that dB dt plus dE equals 0. I hope I have these right. D star N, the star operator in three dimensions, that's the electric current. And dE dt plus d star n b is jE. Okay. So those are Maxwell's equations with C set equal to 1, in fact. All right. Now, how are they usually written? So I've written it in terms of electric and magnetic, just to emphasize the duality. But usually we write it in terms of a single two-form F, which is B minus dt wedge E. That's a two-form in space-time M. And we write the current and the charge are written in terms of a single three-form, which is rho E plus dt wedge J E. So this is a three-form on M. But remember that it has compact spatial support. It's not compactly supported in the time direction, but it's compactly supported on any space-like slice. And the Maxwell equations, then, are the equations that df equals 0 and d star f is this electric current. Okay, so that's the form in which, for example, so the star operator here, I should say, is the star operator of the Lorentz metric on Minkowski space. So that's the form in which the Lorentz invariance of Maxwell's equation is manifest. So this is the Lorentz metric. Okay, so that is right. I think it was Poincaré who actually discovered, I think, mathematician, that Maxwell's equations are Poincaré invariant, oddly enough. Okay, now we can also add, which isn't done in the classical theory, but we could add a magnetic current to make this look more symmetric. So this is, again, a three-form in M with compact spatial support. And we can set that equal to that. And so that's the magnetic current. And now the equations are quite symmetric, right? There's a symmetry. If I exchange F with star F, and I exchange the magnetic current with the electric current. Okay, so that's the form in which we want to think about Maxwell's equations. And in classical field theory, well, what you do is you, given J, for example, we might solve for F. That's some kind of wave equations. And the space of solutions is our classical phase space. And what's not written in these equations is a Poisson bracket. You have a representation of Poincaré groups, so you have some kind of classical system defined by those equations. Okay. So already we see the differential forms, as I said, Maxwell's equations written in those terms. Now, what are the currents? So let me just point out that one source of current is to have point particles. So imagine that this is our space N, which is just a Euclidean 3 space. And so point particles are just a bunch of little dots there with charges attached. So we might have a charge Q1, Q2, Q3. And so we can describe that by saying we have a zero-dimensional submanifold of our space. And in fact, it's a compact submanifold. So those are our finite number of point charges. And we have a function Q from this submanifold to the reals. So in other words, Q is just a zero form on P. And that's what describes our point particles. OK. And so that's the static picture, if we just have space at one time. And the space-time picture is that, now we have space-time. Can't possibly draw. And we have these particles now move, potentially, or static, whatever. And so we just have a one-dimensional submanifold, time-like, inside M4. And we again have a function Q, which is a zero form on W. But Q is closed. It's a locally constant, right? So I just have a number that's on each world line of each particle that describes the particle. Okay, and so the electric current, we would say, is simply the push forward by the inclusion of this Q, which gives us a three form on M. Now let me make some comments about what that push forward is. Okay, one thing I should say, by the way, which I didn't comment here, is notice that the currents are closed. That follows from Maxwell's equations. They're exact, so they're obviously closed. And of course, this being the push forward of something closed also satisfies that it's closed. Now, how do I push this forward to a 3-form? Well, the most natural thing is not to push it forward to a 3-form, but to push it forward to a current in the sense of Durham, that is to say, a function on forms. So let's do the push forward, let's say, in the static picture. So I just have a bunch of points, and I'm pushing forward to 3 dimensions. And so the natural thing to get would be a distribution in the sense of a function on a functional of functions. Namely, given a function, then I would evaluate at each of these points and multiply by the given q and add up the numbers. That would be a functional. But the push forward here, what I want to get is a 3-form. I want to really think of the current as a smooth 3-form. And to do that, we have to make some sort of choice. Namely, we have to choose a little bump form around each of these. And so the 3-form we get, we can think of, is supported in the neighborhood of each of these points. And the integral of that 3-form around each of those points gives me the charge. That's what the current is. So we have to make some choice. It's good to work with smooth forms because eventually we'll start multiplying these currents, and it's rather dangerous to multiply distributions. Now, let me comment on some slightly subtle point which came up in this morning's lecture as well, which is that, you see, when I describe the push forward in terms of a functional on functions, namely evaluate the function and multiply by these numbers, then that was defined just by having this submanifold, these points, inside space. If I describe it as a differential form, then I said that the integral of the form near this point has to be q1. Well, to do that integration, I need to use an orientation, because to integrate a differential form, we need orientation. And the orientation we're using is, in fact, in the normal directions to the point. So the natural push forward does not really give us a form, but it gives us a density, which is a twisted form. It's twisted by the orientation. You see, the density is the distribution, the thing we would get without that. So having the orientation is what gives us a form, which is something that represents cohomology. So there's already an orientation being used here. It's not an orientation really on the points. It's an orientation on the normal bundle. So orientation, in any case, makes sense for points. But when we push forward the charge and think of it as a current in the global space, then we need to use an orientation on the normal bundle. That will lead to something quite a bit more subtle when we do the analogous thing for D-brains, when we push forward the analogous thing there to get the current, and then you need an orientation again on the normal bundle. Okay. So that's a typical sort of charged object in the Maxwell theory. We could also have charged fields, but let's settle with that. Okay. Now, what is charge? I haven't said yet what charge is. And, well, there's a nice discussion of that, actually. I'm sure it's a standard discussion, but I learned it nicely from a paper of Moore and Litton a few years ago, which is really the following. You see, I've said that in the spatial directions that this current is compact, has compact support. And it's certainly closed. So it gives me a cohomology class with compact supports. Now, it looks from this equation as if these currents are exact, but nobody says that this field has compact support. So while it's true that the cohomology class of these currents vanishes in absolute cohomology, meaning in ordinary cohomology without supports, what's possible is that the cohomology class with supports is non-zero. So in other words, the current JE defines, in this case, a class in the compactly supported cohomology of space, which is simply the reals. So here we're doing Durham cohomology. That's the reals. And that's what's called the electric charge. So let me call that Q bar E. The reason for the bar will emerge eventually. That's the electric charge, and similarly we have a magnetic charge if we allow magnetic current. Now when we go to more general spaces and space times, well, let's say spaces, n, then it's true that the currents carry a cohomology class in the compactly supported cohomology, but the image of that class in the in the ordinary cohomology vanishes. That's what Maxwell's equations say. So in general, the charge lives in the kernel of the inclusion from the compactly supported cohomology into the absolute cohomology.
Why is it obvious that J lives in the cohomology? The idea of J equals 0, what about the
cohomology? Well, DJ equals 0, so any closed form defines a cohomology class. Right, so that's exactly what I'm considering here, is its equivalence class under that relation. So for example here, you see the current J carries the information of where the charges are located and how much charge there is. The cohomology class, which is the charge as opposed to the current, only carries the information of Q1 plus Q2 plus Q3. So if I start moving these charges around, that Q doesn't change. So it's much less information, of course, to have the cohomology class under that equivalence than to have the actual current.
J is defined on Minkowski pool space?
Yes, but the charge is something you get by looking on a space, you know, fixed time, let's say. Right? Looking at the cohomology class at fixed time. Or you might think that you just integrate the current over time. That will be.
This notation is to evaluate the cohomology class.
Oh, I'm sorry, yeah. T fixed. Thanks. Okay, so that's the classical setup. And now, what does Dirac charge quantization say? Well, what's a crude form of Dirac charge quantization? Here, it says basically that in the appropriate units, that these charges are integers rather than real numbers. Now let me emphasize that that's not something in the classical theory. This is something in the quantum theory. Okay. So the question is, in a sense, how to implement that in the quantum theory. Now, what does that mean? The game is changing. We're going to do a quantum field theory rather than a classical field theory. If we do a classical field theory, we're trying to describe, you know, some symplectic manifold where I have a time evolution, Poisson brackets, and all that. We have a classical system. Now we want to describe a quantum system, and we're describing it in terms of these fields. So I want to think of these fields as really inputs into a functional integral that we're going to do to define correlation functions. And we want these fields that we use in the functional integral to somehow encode that by the time in the quantum theory we compute these charges, it's automatic that they're quantized. So the question is to construct the right geometric objects as inputs into that. Okay. Now, another way to say this is that this cohomology class of J, let me just use J generically for either the electric or the magnetic current, again at T fixed, that saying that under this isomorphism it's real is really saying that this lives in the integer cohomology inside the real cohomology. Okay. Well, you know, for this Maxwell one-form field, or two-form field, rather, inside three-dimensional space, four-dimensional space-time, there's not much going on. We just have that one cohomology group. But we can obviously consider the more general situation, which comes up in these higher-dimensional theories. So we want to allow our space to be higher dimensional and allow these forms to have arbitrary degree. So in other words, we'll consider now M to be n-dimensional, to be again, for the moment, time cross space. But now where n is not necessarily 4. And we'll consider F, this field strength F that enters into Maxwell's equations, which haven't yet disappeared, will now be a D-form on M, no support condition. And, well, the J's now have different degrees. This is a D plus 1 form on M, So if we have this equation, F is a D form, DF is the magnetic current, that's a D plus 1 form, and you can work out that this is an N plus, what is it? N minus D plus 1 form on M. And again, these have compact spatial support. And now the charges, Q bar E, this lives in the N minus D plus 1 cohomology of space at a fixed time with real coefficients in the classical theory. And this guy, similarly, in the, whatever it is, D plus 1 cohomology of M. Okay. So depending on what N is, these are vector spaces of potentially higher dimension. Okay. Let me remark that you can think of D and all of my indices as being a multi-index here. In other words, we might not have a single form of some degree, but we might have several forms. For example, when we treat Ramon-Ramon fields, there are several forms that occur, and we can think of that as a multi-index. Okay. And also with this generalization, I won't write it down, but we can generalize currents created by, instead of point particles, we could have extended objects like brains. So we could have submanifolds of N, their world volumes as they move there. We can start with a differential form of some degree on the surface, which is closed, and we can push it forward in the same sense. And now the question of orientation, again, to do that push forward, becomes potentially more interesting. Okay, so in this kind of situation, you can easily think of having brains which are charged in a similar way as point particles. Okay, so how do we do charge quantization now in this generalized context? Well, this is where one has the benefit of hindsight. I think what was traditionally done was to generalize what was done in the Maxwell equation by saying that, well, we should have integer charge, you know, instead of arbitrary real charges, we should have integer charges. That means that the cohomology class of the current for fixed time is an integral cohomology, and therefore it's very natural to take inside the real cohomology the integral cohomology and ask that the currents, as cohomology classes, the charges, live there. So we have this vector space, which is our real cohomology of some degree, whatever the degree is, let's say Q. And inside it, to do charge quantization, we want to find a full lattice. That means a top dimensional lattice inside there. Well, we know now with hindsight that that the lattice that one chooses need not be the lattice of integral cohomology. Physicists merely had to ask a topologist to discover that any cohomology theory, any generalized cohomology theory, describes a lattice inside real cohomology. So there are different lattices that are described depending on the cohomology theory. So the sort of first step that one wants to do is to take a full lattice to restrict that Q bar lies in some lattice, let me call it gamma bar, and some lattice inside the real cohomology. Some full lattice. That's what charge quantization, how it will be implemented. And the second step, once you've done that, is to refine Q, Q bar, to a charge Q, which actually lives in the cohomology group itself, not in its image inside real cohomology. So if we think about the integral cohomology of a space, of a manifold, for example, then that maps into the real cohomology, and that map has a kernel, which is the torsion inside the integer cohomology. And so just knowing the image in real cohomology doesn't always pin down a cohomology class. There might be a choice of a lift to integer cohomology by doing the torsion. And similarly for any cohomology theory, K-theory or what have you, just knowing the image inside real cohomology, which for K-theory is the Chern character, doesn't determine the cohomology class. And so it's natural to say that the charge is refined to a cohomology class. Okay. Yes?
What happens with the condition that the Q bar should be in the kernel of the map?
That's true.
So the lattice that you're describing is only a lattice in the kernel or in the cohomology?
Ah. Well, it's in the kernel, but very soon I'm going to go to a situation where everything's compact, and I ignored that. But yes, that's true. But okay, now why should we expect actually that we get a cohomology theory? Well, here's one sort of hand-waving argument, which is that what we want to do if we start thinking about quantum field theory with variable spaces and perhaps variable space-times is we want to assign to each space-time some lattice inside the real cohomology, which is where the charges are. And as with anything else in quantum field theory, we want that lattice to depend locally on the space-time. So we want to assign a lattice inside real cohomology that depends locally on space-time. Well, that's exactly what a cohomology theory is. The locality is expressed by the Mayer-Vitoris principle. So in some sense, you might say that wanting the lattice to depend locally on the space or space-time is going to lead you, perhaps, to think about cohomology theories. Yes?
You say that the charges take values in cohomology, but we are used to think of charges as something that takes values in cohomology.
Well, for example, in the Noether theory, where you have charges associated to conserved symmetries, right? You get a current, and then you integrate that over a space-like slice to compute the charge. That's the way I learned it in books. And so integration is simply computing the cohomology class of that current. So in some sense, it's the current. On the other hand, you're right that the charged objects often appear more naturally as homology objects. And I've done the sort of push forward to translate them into the dual cohomology class. That's Poincaré duality, the same Poincaré of the group. Okay, so that's what I want to say, again, with hindsight, because the examples weren't there before. But with hindsight, you could say that to implement this quantization of charge, whenever you have fields which are differential forms, we have to choose a cohomology theory and decide that our charges get refined into that cohomology theory. So our task really, you see, is that we have now this charge, Q, which lives in some cohomology theory. We still have J, which is a differential form. So this is a differential form. This is some cohomology class. And again, by cohomology, well, I want to say integer cohomology class, but by integer cohomology, I mean any cohomology theory, like K-theory, for example. And so what we need to do is to clearly refine this to some new object which carries the information of both of these things. So it has to carry the information of a current. We want to know where our charges are located, not just what the total charge is. And yet it should carry the information that the total charge is quantized by whatever condition we want. So that's the sort of language in which we want to recast the Maxwell equations, of course not as classical equations, but in a quantum theory, to be able to write down a quantum theory where charge will be quantized. Once we've done that, then if you thought about the Maxwell theory, then it's clear that the field strength F, well, that's also going to carry some sort of quantization law, I'll comment on. And again, that will be refined to some object in that theory, the same theory. They have to live in the same theory. We have equations like df equals jb. Okay, so I think it's clear we need that as well. All right. Now let me just comment, what is the choice of different cohomology theories? How does that affect the quantization of charge? Well, it affects it in two ways, we might say. One is that this lattice that we get, you know, is shifted depending on which cohomology theory we get. For example, the lattice we get from K-theory is a little bit different from the lattice we get from integer cohomology. They're subtle effects having to do with small integers, the integers rise with the dimension. But nevertheless, the lattices are different. So which actual differential forms you're allowed will change depending on the cohomology theory. The second difference is, as I mentioned, there's a kernel in passing from the integer cohomology group to tensoring with the reals and sitting it inside real cohomology. And the different torsion charges that are allowed will vary depending on the cohomology theory. Torsion in K-theory looks quite different from torsion in integer cohomology. So those are the places where you might see. Now, how do you choose what is the right quantization law? Well, that's the input that you need from the quantum theory. That input comes from many different directions. For example, the conclusion that K-theory is the right cohomology theory to choose for the Ramon charges in type 2, the evidence for that comes from many, many different directions. We'll see some of it from anomalies, but there are lots of other pieces of evidence for that. So I'm not going to talk in these lectures about the rationale, except for anomalies, for which cohomology theory one chooses, but we'll take it as given. Okay. And really, a better formulation, as you'll see, would be not that we choose one lattice for both the electric and magnetic charge, but in a sense they're in dual lattices, and it's the product that has to have some correct integrality. Okay. Let me also comment that it's not enough, as we'll see, to simply say that, well, okay, we had a differential form, let's just constrain it to lie in this lattice, right? We could just constrain the differential form so that its cohomology class lies in our chosen lattice, and we can choose a lifting of that real cohomology class to our integral cohomology theory. So let's just work with pairs of these, which are compatible in the sense that the real image of this cohomology class is the Durham cohomology class of that J. That would be our first guess, to work with such pairs. But we'll find that there's something a little bit more subtle that happens in refining here. This is not simply a choice of compatible things. This maps to such a choice, but there's actually a kernel in that map. And roughly, you see, what happens here is, well, we need to consider local objects that make up a gauge theory, and we'll need something more subtle than simply compatible pairs. Okay, so as I said, we want to do this in the context of an action principle, not in the context of the classical field equations, because this is part of the quantum theory, not part of the classical theory. So let's first reformulate Maxwell theory. Well, so we'll reformulate the Maxwell theory as an action principle, Maxwell's equations, and then we'll see how to do this. But before that, this is a good chance to just discuss for 5 minutes action principles in general. Okay. So actually, the first step is that we'll take our space-time, and we'll rotate the time to imaginary time tau, and t is the square root of minus 1 times tau. So that's the standard Wick rotation. We'll work in Euclidean framework, and then, well, we'll allow ourselves to replace this by any n-dimensional Riemannian manifold, and since I'm working with differential forms, well, it should be oriented as well, the way that I'm writing it. We could write it without the orientation, but let's just have it oriented. So we'll formulate the action principle here, but let me emphasize that we're not going to be trying to write down a classical field theory. So what we have in such a Lagrangian theory is we have a space of fields, and that space should, in some sense, depend locally on x. And then typically, we have a function on the space of fields called the action. And in the Euclidean case, in Minkowski space, it always takes real values. That's one of the principles of CPT. But in Euclidean space, the fields and the action might be complex. So this is the action. And now, in the classical theory, before we Rick rotate, if we write down the action principle here, then we're trying to find the critical points of this function. Those are the So to get an action principle for Maxwell's equations, for example, we want a space of fields and an action so that its critical point equations reproduce exactly Maxwell's equations. That's what we want. In the quantum theory, once we have the theory formulated that way, then in the quantum theory, we compute, rather than this, we compute, we integrate over the space, e to the minus in the Euclidean case, the action, and then we put in some functions on f of x, operators, and we integrate against this wonderful measure dA, and that computes correlation functions. And if there's no operators there, that's called the partition function. Now, this is modified in two ways in the story that we'll tell. So one modification is that, in fact, f of x may be a category. So instead of a set of fields, we actually have a category of fields. So when we consider gauge fields, we'll have gauge fields, but we'll also have an equivalence between gauge fields. And what we really integrate over are the equivalence classes of gauge fields. So what we really integrate over are the equivalence classes. Okay, so that's just to say that fields might be more complicated than simply a set or the measure that we integrate over. Okay, but the other geometric change is that, in fact, this e to the minus s might not be defined as a complex function, but might be a section of a Hermitian. Let me write that. So it will happen, and we'll see an example already today, that the natural formulation of an action principle leads not to a function, s, for the action. So s may not be well-defined. In some cases, we'll see that only e to the minus s is well-defined as a map to the complex numbers. That's certainly OK. It's OK for both the classical and quantum if s isn't defined, but e to the minus s is defined, because you see we can still take the differential. That makes perfect sense. And we can still integrate that if e to the minus s is all we need. But what's worse is that there might be a Lyman bundle, a Hermitian Lyman bundle with unitary connection, let's say script L, of x over the space of fields, and e to the minus s is a section of this Lyman bundle. So rather than having a fixed copy of the complex numbers and the action taking values for each field configuration in the complex numbers, we now have, so to speak, a variable copy of the complex numbers as we move over field space. So that copy of the complex numbers, the codomain for the action, varies as well as the action. Yes? Well, in the examples it is. I'm just giving you the general framework. Yes?
Why? Classes there, or what?
Yes. For example, we're used to thinking of gauge fields, as I said, with, well, we're going to do really the circle group. That's really the fundamental example. But let's take a gauge field whose structure group is a finite group. That's a very beautiful sort of field. It's a very discrete sort of field. So what do you have over a manifold? Well, what you have is a principal G bundle, where G is that finite group. Well, that's just a covering space, a principal Galois covering space. And, well, there's no choice of connection. It's just flat. It's just the covering space. But covering spaces you can map to one another, right? You have equivalence classes. There's, for a compact space, a finite set of equivalence classes, but they themselves form a category. So that's maybe a simple-minded example, but it shows you what I meant there. In general, if you have a continuous group, you have the same thing. You have different principal bundles, and then you have the local data in addition of the connection. Okay. Other questions? That is the point. So when the complex lines vary, we can't integrate. You see, the instruction to integrate is to multiply that quantity by a positive number. That's what the measure is, and then add. Well, we can certainly multiply something in a complex line by a positive number. That's no problem. But we can't add things which take values in different lines. Right. There's no way to add them. We can certainly integrate functions into a fixed vector space, for example, but we can't integrate a function with values in a different vector space. On the other hand, if we were doing the classical theory, that would be perfectly fine here. We would just interpret the D as the connection, covariant derivative, on this line bundle, and we could still formulate the equation. And in fact, there are many interesting equations in geometry, variational equations, which appear that way. But as in a quantum field theory, as Mike points out, we get into trouble. So this is what's called an anomaly. So in this situation, we can't do the quantum theory, whereas we could do the classical theory. So that's a Lagrangian interpretation of what an anomaly is. An anomaly is this line bundle, the non-triviality of that line bundle. Okay, so we'll see, as I said, in the context of that we're working in with these gauge fields, that when they're simultaneously JB and JE, that will produce an action which has precisely this geometric form, has an anomaly. Okay, so later on I'll discuss more about anomalies and what it means to cancel. But that's the sort of framework I mean for having an action principle. Okay, any other questions? Okay, so let's now go on and write the Maxwell equations in terms of an action principle. Well, the Maxwell equations have disappeared, but at least the fields that we have in their various degrees are still on the board. I'll remind you that the Maxwell equations are that df is JB and d star f is the electric current. Okay, so we want those to be, if you like, the Euler-Lagrange equations of an action principle. Well, let's first take the case where the currents are both zero, and then we'll slowly add the currents. So the right-hand side of both equations is zero. Well, in fact, we're not going to get both equations as Euler-Lagrange equations. We'll get this as an Euler-Lagrange equation, but we'll build that first equation, which is now df equals zero, into the picture. So remember, we're working on a n-dimensional manifold, which is Riemannian and oriented. And let me further add compact, just so I don't have to talk about convergence or anything. And so what we'll introduce is, so we're first doing the classical theory. And so let's introduce A, which is a d minus 1 form on M. Okay, that's going to be the variable. So fx, at first glance, is going to be the space of all of these. We'll see that's not quite right in a minute. But so our variable in the action is a d minus 1 form. That's the gauge field. And we'll simply set f to be dA. That's the f associated to A. So that means that the first Maxwell equation is satisfied. That implies that df is 0. So in other words, in the case when there's no magnetic current, the f, the field strength, is closed. And now I'm really adding an additional classical equation, which is that the cohomology class also vanishes. So if the cohomology class of f vanishes, which is something that we're going to impose, then f is in fact equal to dA. Okay. So A is the variable, and now we can write very simply the action. S of A is 1 over 2 d squared, the integral over x of dA star dA, where E is some real number called the coupling constant. Okay, so that's a very simple linear action. And if you compute the Euler-Lagrange equations, then you see that you get this equation with right-hand side 0. So that's the standard action with the sign for Euclidean space for a gauge field. Now, you notice in this action, though, there is a gauge invariance. Namely, all that enters into the action is the differential of A, not A itself. And so if I change A by adding d sigma, where sigma is any d minus 2 form, then of course I don't change the action. And so we can take our space of fields, therefore, to be the quotient of the d minus 1 forms by the differential of the d minus 2 forms. So that's a perfectly good vector space, that quotient. And that vector space is our space of fields. That's a free theory. Our space of fields is a vector space. The action is quadratic.
Is that a vector or a bar?
There's no category here. It's just a set. If you want, you could think of a little category, right? You could, but then it's fx bar. But let's just take that to be fx. So the space of fields is that quotient. Okay. No, certainly the field doesn't. No, I don't. Usually you do the variational principle. The variations usually have compact support, I mean, to compute the Euler-Lagrange equations. But the equations themselves certainly don't. If you do a scalar field with a potential whose minimum isn't at zero, I mean, you'd find, you know, the field can be non-zero everywhere, but the equations of motion you derive locally. I am assuming X is, I'm assuming X, which is Euclidean, is compact. Right. But the question would stand. In any case, this is the classical formulation where I'm thinking of, again, time cross space, which you could think of as non-compact. I just mean this to be the absolutely standard variational formulation of Maxwell's equations. I don't, nothing else. Okay. And now we can add the electric current. This is, again, fairly standard, which is that we write the action as 1 over 2 e squared integral dA wedge star dA. That's the kinetic term. Sorry. And then in Euclidean space, the next term, and I'm putting in 2 pi's in some standard places, I think, is the integral of this electric current wedge A. Okay. Now, this A lives in a quotient space, so we have to be sure that this term makes sense. And saying that this term makes sense on the quotient space is exactly saying that this J is closed. And that was our condition for the current. Okay, so that term certainly makes sense on the quotient space. And if you compute the Euler-Lagrange equations, you will get Maxwell's equation, the second equation, D star F equals J. Well, that's what you would get if you do it in Minkowski signature, where we have, as I say, time cross space, and this term, rather than being plus I, would be minus 1 over 2 pi times that. Then we would indeed get Maxwell's equations with some constant there. If we do it in Euclidean space and try to compute the classical equations, then we'll get that the derivative of the left-hand side, d star f, is I, square root of minus 1, times j, which is rather ridiculous because j and f are both real. So we get a nonsensical equation. This causes infinite confusion to mathematicians in a slightly different context, which is trying to reconcile self-duality with quantization and so on. But the point, as I finally came to realize, is that we're not trying to compute those classical equations. That's not the point of doing the Euclidean field theory. We're just doing it as an input to the functional integral. So again, in real time, in Minkowski space-time, we do produce Maxwell's equations, but here, we don't look at that. Okay. So that's the absolutely standard story. And let me just, maybe I'll leave that up. And let me just point out that if we have a, if the electric current is the push forward of some charge where we have some submanifold of x and q is, well, let's say it's a zero form of w, didn't have to be zero, then what is that term? The integral of je wedge a is simply the integral over the submanifold of q times. So that's a form in which you might see it more often, that you integrate the gauge field over the world line, for example, of a particle times the charge. So W was the world line of a particle when we really had space-time. But now we have a compact Euclidean manifold X, and W is some submanifold. Okay. And Q is some differential form, well, let's say a zero form on W. So W might have several components. So think of these as Euclidean analogs of world lines of particles. And the Q, which is just a number, dQ equals zero, it's just a number on each component, is just representing the charge of that particle. And so we said before that the current is the Poincaré dual of that, the push forward. And now, therefore, this integral of the current against A is simply the integral on that submanifold of Q times A. Okay. So that's perhaps a more familiar form for that term. Okay. No, I think that would work in general. We just have to adjust the degrees, perhaps. I mean, okay. Okay, so now let's so we haven't put in a JB. I haven't put in any magnetic current, which usually isn't there in any case in the classical formulation. And we haven't put in the quantization of charge. So this is what one would get in classical Maxwell theory. So now let's put in the quantization of charge. So now put in the quantization of electric charge first. Okay. So the idea is that what we're going to do is expand the possibilities, so to speak, for A. And by expanding the possibilities for A, in other words, by integrating over a larger space of A's, we're going to restrict more the possibilities for what J's can go there. Okay. So the idea is that it's e to the minus s, which must make sense. And so that implies that we need the integral of J wedge A. This thing doesn't have to be make sense as a real number, but it only has to make sense up to shifts by, well, not integers, but the way I've done it, 2 pi squared times integers. Right. So if I shift this by 2 pi squared times an integer, I over 2 pi times, it shifts by 2 pi I times an integer, and therefore e to the minus 2 pi I times the integer is 1, and so that doesn't change at all. So for e to the minus s to make sense, we're allowed to make sense of this in this quotient, rather than just as a real number. Okay, so how can we take advantage of it? Well, let's do absolutely simplest example, which is we're going to take d equals 1, first of all. So if d is equal to 1, then, and let's also take n equal to 0. So in other words, x is just a point. That's not a very physical situation, but mathematically it will illustrate what I want to illustrate. So our integral over x is just evaluating this at a point. So in fact, je and a are both simply real numbers. And so this integral is simply the product of those real numbers. So now what we're going to do is simply sort of generalize A to be an element, not of the reals, but of the circle, of R mod 2 pi z. So in other words, we'll let A not be real valued, but circle valued. So in general, if we had d equals 1, even in higher dimensions, that means the field strength is a 1 form, and so the gauge field itself is a 0 form. So that's a scalar field. And so what I'm saying is that we're going to replace a real-valued scalar field by a circle-valued scalar field in general. Of course, a real-valued scalar field, we can exponentiate and get a circle-valued scalar field, but not all circle-valued scalar fields have logarithms when we have non-trivial pi 1, non-trivial first homology. Okay. So if we let A be an element of this circle, then what happens to J? Well, we want the product J times A to make sense in here. And so we find that J must be an element 2 pi z inside R. So in other words, just If I look at the product J times A, if they're both real numbers, that product makes sense as a real number. Now, if I only know A up to shifts by 2 pi times an integer, and I want to know the product up to shifts by 2 pi squared times an integer, then I better have that J is itself 2 pi times an integer. Okay? So just letting A be an element in this, introducing the circle, automatically quantizes, so to speak, J. It wasn't. It's just because I want e to the minus s to make sense. Yeah, so I mean, I'm allowed to shift s by s plus 2 pi I times an integer. And I have an I over 2 pi in front of this, so I'm allowed a 2 pi squared to make 2 pi times an integer. That's all. It's just the normalization I use for the 2 pi's. I think they're the usual ones, but sorry, maybe I should have normalized them differently. Okay, so introducing this topology of passing from the reals to the circle automatically quantizes electric charge. That's the simplest case of implementing Dirac charge quantization by changing the geometric nature of what the gauge field is. Okay? All right. Now, usually we write here, we write A is e to the I phi. Right? So A is now an element of the circle, suitably normalized circle, and we write it as the exponential of phi, as if phi is a real-valued scalar field. But when we go, but it's not phi, phi is not defined. It's only the symbol e to the I phi in total that's defined there. So I'm going to use that notation, e to the I phi, but remember that phi is not defined. So the symbol is one symbol, e to the I phi. So e, right. So now we'll do n arbitrary, but still stick with d equals 1 and see what it looks like. And so now our gauge field A is e to the I phi. That's a map from x into the circle, T. So T is the circle. It's the unit circle inside the complex line. Okay, so the complex line has the elements of norm 1. That's the unit circle, T. That's an element, a phase of norm 1. So ordinarily, a scalar field, when we have d equals 1, the field strength's a 1 form, the gauge field's a 0 form, that's usually a map from x to the reals. And now this more geometric thing with charge quantization is to take it to be rather a circle-valued gauge field. Okay, so now I want to look at that coupling term again. And so let's imagine, so we have x, which is n-dimensional, and now let's imagine we have a zero-dimensional submanifold of x. So this is the world volume of a minus 1 brain. I guess that would be the right lingo. And so here's x, and we simply have now a bunch of points. Okay, those points can be electrically charged under this. Yes? Right. Well, I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm mixing up multiplicative and additive notation. You're right. Yeah, the place I used to have A is phi. Okay. Well, maybe I should write it better. You're right. So let's write it as, I don't know, phi bar is mapping to R mod something. Is it 2 pi z probably? Okay, thank you. So I should write it additively rather than multiplicatively. Okay, fine. So instead of having a real-valued scalar field, we have a real-valued scalar field, but we only know it up to shifts by 2 pi times integers. And now we want to put something that's magnetically charged, well, electrically charged, rather. So it'll just be a bunch of points in the space-time, which you could think of as a negative 1 brain, I think is what it's called. And again, we have numbers attached. So we'll have some electric charge, which is just a function on the zero manifold, which naively takes values in R. That was before we quantized. But let's see what this term looks like. So if we take the exponential of minus I over 2 pi times the integral of j dot a, so remember a is a zero form, this j, if you work it out, is an n form, then the j that's gotten by push forward of this q. So the reason I'm exponentiating minus times it, remember in the action we had plus I times it, but we're looking at e to the minus s. So this is a factor in e to the minus s. This is the product over the points w in w of e to the minus I phi at w. That now makes sense because phi is in there. Phi bar, I don't care. And this thing raised to the power q of w divided by 2 pi. Okay. So I said in general that this electric coupling term is the integral over the submanifold of q times a in the case when it's gotten by pushing forward. And so the integral over the zero-dimensional manifold is simply the sum over those points, except we're exponentiating, so we get a product. We have to integrate q times a. Well, a is phi, and q times it is q times phi. And there was a 2 pi. So that's what we get. Now, this is an element of the circle, and we have to take that element to some power. Well, if you have an element of the circle, you can't, for example, take a square root. There are two square roots on the circle. That's not well defined. But we can take integer powers. So this is defined if we have that the electric charge is, again, 2 pi times an integer. Okay. So it's just a simple generalization of what happened when we had just a point. Okay. So again, letting this thing be circle valued quantizes the electric charge. Okay. So that's really one main lesson, is that to quantize electric charge, we have to change the nature of the gauge field to make it, instead of real valued, circle valued, at least in this zero form case. We have to think of what to do in the higher dimensional case, higher degree case, rather. And electric charge is always given by a term, an additional term in the action here, so an additional factor in the exponentiated action. And that factor now will only make sense in the exponential. It won't make sense before we exponentiate. Okay? So we still have a perfectly good action. It's now a function. S itself doesn't make sense as a function to the complex numbers, but e to the minus s still makes sense. Okay, so that's how we can quantize electric charge. So the final step is to introduce magnetic charge. So now we want to introduce not only magnetic charge, but magnetic current. Okay. So here we're going to have to rethink from the beginning our action formulation, because before we had df equals 0, and then we introduced a gauge field A whose differential is f. So we got this. We sort of implied this by introducing A, where dA is equal to f. Now we're going to write the equation df equals jb. So clearly we have to change what we mean by A. We can't have A anymore. So that's a difference in the formulation between electric and magnetic current. Electric current puts a new term in the action. Magnetic current changes what we mean by the gauge field. Okay, so they're implemented in a very asymmetric way. Nevertheless, in the quantum theory, there's a duality. But the way we see it here is very asymmetric. Okay, so let's assume that that this thing is quantized. And so let me do, again, the case n arbitrary in d equals 1. Okay. So I'm only going to discuss it today for this scalar gauge field. I should have remarked, by the way, that for the scalar gauge field I did once earlier, there's no gauge principle. I mean, a gauge transformation would be a negative 1 form. So it's just an ordinary scalar field. This is usually written as an insertion into the path integral. It's a local operator in this case. But I want to think of it as this electric coupling. Okay, so let me assume from the beginning this magnetic current is now a two-form, and let me assume that its cohomology class is already quantized. Okay. Well, geometrically, we know we can recognize how to represent such an object geometrically. Namely, geometrically, how are we going to represent this? Well, this is the, remember, this is the magnetic charge, except this is the magnetic charge, its image inside the real cohomology. We're meant to think that there's also an honest magnetic charge, which is a two-dimensional integral cohomology class. I'll keep the 2 pi. Right. This is its image inside H2 of X, R. Okay. Well, two-dimensional cohomology classes are really given by principal circle bundles over the space X. And we're supposed to have not only this Q, but we're supposed to have the current J, which is a two-form. And having a two-form with that cohomology class means that we can represent this, represent this current as I times is the square root of minus 1 times the curvature of a principal circle bundle. Let's call it PB with connection and first chunk class equal to this refined charge. So giving us this refined magnetic charge gives us a topological bundle. That gives us the first chunk class. And giving the differential form gives us the curvature. Now, I said before, earlier in the lecture, that just having the J and the Q compatible isn't enough to give us the geometric object. And you see that that's true. Because, for example, suppose that Q and J are both zero. In other words, we have a topologically trivial bundle and zero curvature. We could still have non-trivial connections. Namely, we could have flat connections on the trivial bundle. And that's the sort of thing which is which this geometric representative carries, which the information that the current and that characteristic class, the charge, don't carry. But it's very natural geometrically to represent this magnetic charge, magnetic current rather, by this geometric object, a circle bundle with connection. So now how are we meant to interpret this equation? This is the Maxwell equation we want to interpret now. We've interpreted this two-form geometrically when we want to quantize the charge as being the curvature of a bundle. That quantizes that two-form. And how are we going to interpret F? Well, F is supposed to be a one-form whose differential is that curvature. And so we'll interpret the gauge field phi, but really we can't interpret phi anymore. But the exponentiated gauge field e to the I phi is now interpreted as a section of this guy. Okay. And F, which is now going to be honestly a one-form on X, its covariant derivative. So that's geometrically how I want to interpret these equations. So before we had the JB, this F was closed. It was a closed one-form. And we represented F as the differential of a map to the circle. If we have a map to the circle, it has a differential, or d log of it, which is that one form. And if you have a map to the circle, its differential has integral periods. But now we have that f is a one form, which isn't closed. we've interpreted the magnetic current, that two-form, as this principal circle bundle. And now the gauge field, which before was this scalar, is now, instead of being this exponentiated one, instead of that being a map to the circle, now that's going to be a map to a variable circle, the variable circle given by this magnetic current. So, if you like a slogan, the gauge field is a trivialization of the magnetic current. So we have to change the nature of the gauge field, and what it is a trivialization of the magnetic current. Well, the bundle is always trivial. So remember, Maxwell's equation says that DF equals J. So just on the level of forms, J is exact as an absolute cohomology class. It might not be exact as a compactly supported cohomology class. But as an absolute cohomology class, J is always exact. And in this geometric formulation, we've represented the magnetic current, JB, by this bundle. And that bundle is always trivial, you know, globally. Yes. That is equal to zero, right. Okay, so I've sort of dropped the support conditions because I just assumed once and for all X was compact. But we'd have to go back if we wanted to do this properly in the case where I really have time cross space, right? And we really wanted to get a good charge, then you're right. We have to go back. But it's true that the way I've done it, Q is zero. Right. Physicists say that if you have a closed universe, there's no charge. I mean, this is the sort of geometric version of that statement. But if we didn't, then we would have to implement that with support conditions. And then we could have a non-trivial Q, but in the compactly supported cohomology. So the bundle would still be non-trivial, but you see it would come with some trivialization infinity, and we'd have a relative turn class, and that would be the charge. Okay. So that's what we have here. And now we should reconsider our action, finally, and see what that looks like. So what is our action? Well, the kinetic term was 1 over 2 e squared, the integral of f wedge star f. Now, before we had f was dA, which was really d phi. I've called A phi. But now, instead of this, we have f is the covariant derivative of e to the I phi. Well, we have a section, the connection, if you like, is a form, a one-form on the total space. We just pull it down by the section. In any case, we get an honest one-form here, and so there's no problem with this kinetic term making sense. That certainly makes good sense. But what about this electric coupling term? Well, that's now the term that's more interesting. So how do we make sense of that? Well, even without the magnetic current, that term only made sense in the exponentiated action. So the electric coupling factor in the exponentiated action. So that's the product, in this case, let's say, where the current is gotten from these points in space-time. It's the product of e to the minus I phi of w raised to the power QE of W over 2 pi. So what does that look like? How do we make sense of that? Well, remember that here's our space-time X. We now have, what was green before? We now have these points, which are the points of W. And at each point, we have e to the minus I phi. Well, where does e to the minus I phi live? Well, e to the minus I phi lives in the fiber of this principal circle bundle that represents the magnetic charge. Well, let's, instead of taking a principal circle bundle, let's let, let's say, LB over X be the associated Hermitian line bundle with connection associated to this P. Okay, So having a principal circle bundle with connection is absolutely equivalent to having a Hermitian line bundle with connection. We can pass back and forth. So let me think of e to the minus I phi then make sense as an element of unit size inside L. After all, the principal bundle P are exactly the elements of unit size inside that Hermitian line bundle. So we have this LB, we have the fiber of that at W, and e to the minus I phi, well, that's an element of actually not that line, but the inverse line. E to the I phi is in the line, and so e to the minus I phi is in the inverse line. Well, now we're raising it to this power. This power, remember, is an integer. That was the constraint on having the electric charge quantized. So this makes good sense. But where does it live? Well, it lives in the tensor product over all W's and W's of these lines, LB at W to the power, which is tensor minus QE at W over 2 pi. Okay. So the exponentiated action still makes sense. But it's quite naturally, once I have magnetic and electric charge, this electric coupling term makes sense as an element of that particular line. Okay? That's for a particular field configuration, right? Each time I have a phi, that's what I have. But now imagine over the space of fields, and imagine not only the space of fields, but let's also let this W move around. So as we move around over the space of those W's and fields, what we get is that this particular line bundle makes a line bundle with metric and connection, it inherits it from here, and the action then is a section of that. So that's exactly the situation I envisaged in general, where the action is not a complex function, the exponentiated action, but rather a section of a line bundle with connection. Yes?
This question. If f is a covariant derivative of e to the I phi, star f is a form with eyes in the dual bundle?
No. This is all abelian. So this is just an ordinary one form. So, So this is a principal circle bundle. So think of a connection as being a one form on the total space. We have a section, I just pull it back. I get a one form on the base. That's what I mean by covariant derivative. So that's why it's in quotes. But just think of the pullback of the connection one form to the base. Okay, it's the local representation relative to that section of the connection. Scalar one form. So star is just the scalar n minus one form. Okay. So if we were to write a formula for this anomaly, that is to say this line bundle, then let me write the formula. So this anomaly is formally what? Well, it's some sort of integral of the electric current times the magnetic current. See, again, this electric current is dual, Poincaré dual to W. So this would be an integral over W of Q times JB. And that's exactly what we're doing, except there's a negative sign. All right, so there's a negative. Somehow it's formally the exponential of minus I over 2 pi times that. So here finally is where you see the electric current paired with the magnetic current, which is what you expect in charge quantization. It's paired in saying what the anomaly is in the electric coupling term when you have also magnetic current. So what we need to do is to get a mathematical formalism. You see, all I've done is tell you how to treat the case where D is equal to 1, a scalar gauge field, and I've only told it to you when the electric charge is induced in this way from point particles. But we clearly need a different kind of mathematical formulation where we can deal with higher degree forms and have a calculus like this, where we have, for example, multiplication of such objects and also integration. And it must be a little bit of crazy calculus because the result of this integration has to be a line bundle with connection. That's not usually something you think of as the result of an integration process, but nevertheless, there it is. So the plan is that's really the subject for tomorrow, is this generalized differential cohomology. So I'll spend the first part of the lecture giving you some ideas of how that sort of a theory might go, how those mathematical objects might look. And then the second part of the lecture, I'll revisit this context of gauge fields and try to formulate in general what a gauge field is in that context. And if I have time, also discuss a little bit what self-duality is, how we talk about self-dual gauge fields, because that's important in the examples. In the third lecture, then we'll start towards the examples that I want to say where these gauge fields occur. And as a final general preliminary, we'll talk about, I don't know, Dirac-Plouffe fields or something. So this is an old story of how to think of the anomaly from a spinner field when you do the functional integral of a spinner field or a Rita-Schwinger field. And so we'll review that a little bit briefly. And in that context, maybe talk about the index theorem. And then also talk about D-brains in type 2 a little bit and how the anomaly goes. And then if I make it through all that, then the plan is in the fourth lecture to talk about, as I said, the SO version of the type 1, where we meet not K-theory, but actually K-O theory, and we meet quite an interesting mathematical story of how the original Green-Schwarz mechanism works there. Thank you. But I reserve the right to take a little more time. Okay, yes.
Yeah, just your definition of anomaly. Most of this is pretty clear to me, but I'm not quite sure what, you know, how that anomaly relates to what I would imagine is an anomaly and why that is a problem in any of this at all.
Okay. Well, I'll ask you in a minute what you imagine an anomaly to be, but let's take the definition first loosely as a theory which makes sense classically, but which has a problem in its quantization. And I'm taking it in a Lagrangian framework where I have an action principle, fields, and so on. And so what I'm envisioning is that I have a space of fields, which I've called Fx. So x is my space-time, Euclidean version, and f is my space of fields. And in general, the fields might have several components. And now we want to have an action.
Aren't these already equivalents
to gauge
transformation?
Yes. So here.
Is that a problem? Because, I mean, as I understand anomalies, I do a gauge transformation.
Ah. Okay. So if you want to think that way, then you could think that before I make an equivalence, I've made some choices, which I claim are not geometric choices. They violate gluing. What do you call gluing? The cluster decomposition principle and all that. But in any case, you've made some choices so that you can write the action as a number rather than an element of this line. But then you find that those choices are not invariant under gauge transformations, right? So the action is not invariant under gauge transformations. Well, a different way to say that is that we work on the quotient space, modulo gauge transformations, and then the action really does make sense there as something independent of gauge transformations, but it's not anymore a single number. Okay, but it transforms in a line. And what is that line? That line is defined by the cocycle of how your thing transformed under gauge transformation. So maybe that's enough.
Yeah.
Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
Sorry. Can you first tell you went from the bottom right corner of the screen to JE.JB?
Well, this is, in some sense, JB. That was the geometric representation of JB, was this line. Okay. Now, it's again a problem of additive versus multiplicative notation, right? But this is, in some sense, JE. This was the electric current. Okay. So that product I'm thinking of is that line raised to that power. So that's the product. Yes, but it's a product because of this problem that I'm constantly switching between additive and multiplicative notation. Okay. But if we did this, yeah. Okay. If I did it in an additive notation, I might have written it in a way that looked better. For example, if you think rather than a circle bundle, if you think of an R mod 2 pi Z bundle as a principal bundle, then the more natural thing would be to multiply by something rather than add. But take, I mean, that's a more familiar sort of notation. In any case, it's really the product. And yeah, Other questions?